Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Not all Western allies are supporting the missile strike on Syria by the U.S., Russia, I should say Britain and France. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, is criticizing the action, which coalition leaders have said were necessary after the Syrian Assad regime allegedly unleashed chemical weapons on civilians, killing dozens last week.
There is a danger that action that is taken hastily, action that doesn't necessarily contribute to peace, actually risks not just escalating the civil war, but escalating the tensions internationally as well. So this, I think, makes it all the more important that leaders take the time to set out their objectives and strategies carefully.
British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson stands by the action.
We worked with our American friends, our French friends, to degrade Assad's chemical weapons capability. That was the important point. And I hope that this will be a deterrent to him. And obviously, I hope that it will mean no further humanitarian suffering by the Syrian people as a result of the use of chemical weapons.
U.S. President Donald Trump spoke by phone to the leaders of Britain and France about the joint airstrikes. The U.S. Department of Defense said they were targeted in targeting three sites believed to be linked to the production of chemical and biological weapons. The attacks were a retaliation for suspected chemical attacks near Damascus last weekend that killed more than 40 people. Afghanistan reported deadly border skirmishes with Pakistan Sunday, but it was not immediately known who initiated it. A regional Afghan police chief told VOA the clashes erupted early morning along a border district in southeastern province and that the exchange of fire was ongoing. This is VOA News. Myanmar said Saturday it has repatriated its first family of Rohingya refugees. Rights groups say that that move amounts to a publicity stunt because security concerns for the returning Rohingyas have not been addressed. The United Nations refugee group said Friday the conditions in Myanmar are not yet conducive for returns to be safe, dignified, and sustainable. The second annual March for Science was held on the National Mall in Washington Saturday, and more than 200 similar events were held around the world. Scientists who were out marching were protesting government policies on issues from climate change to gun violence they say ignore scientific evidence. This year's march came a year after the first ever March for Science. Organizers say fears that science would be sidelined is why scientists took to the streets a year ago and continue to fight. An American pastor imprisoned in Turkey since December 2016 will go on trial Monday, facing up to 35 years in prison. U.S. pastor Andrew Brunson will stand trial on April 16th, facing charges of committing crimes on behalf of terror groups without being a member and espionage. He was arrested over a year ago for alleged connections to both an outlaw Kurdish insurgent group and followers of an exiled Muslim cleric. Brunson has denied all allegations against him. The United States has repeatedly asked Turkey to release him. While U.S. President Donald Trump remains in the United States to deal with the conflict in Syria, Vice President Mike Pence is in Peru for the Summit of the Americas, where he's smoothing over differences with Mexico, America's southern neighbor, amid unease over Mr. Trump's decision to send troops to the border and also harsh rhetoric on immigration. Also, with tensions over trade, Pence expressed hope alongside Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. could soon agree to a renegotiated North American Free Trade Agreement. The Prime Minister Trudeau.
We will continue to work hard at the negotiating table. We will continue to negotiate in good faith and hope to reach the win-win-win renegotiation of NAFTA that all three parties very much want.
And seated alongside Trudeau, Pence said that there was a real possibility the U.S. could reach a deal with Canada and Mexico and NAFTA within the next several weeks. A storm system stretching from the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes buffeted the central U.S. with heavy snow, winds, rain, and hail, forcing flight cancellations and creating treacherous road conditions that killed at least three people, including a sleeping two-year-old girl in the state of Louisiana. In the upper Midwest, the early spring storm brought snow to a region pining for sunshine and warmth, and around 400 flights were canceled. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It has just ignited a spirit that we think is going to carry South Africa forward. And South Africa can never be the same from the day Winnie Mandela passed on.
South Africans laid to rest anti-apartheid icon Winnie Madikizela Mandela with full state honors.
Raila still commands a huge political following. And what Raila says is basically what significant numbers in opposition are going to follow.
A surprise handshake between Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and main opposition leader Raila Odinga draws mixed reaction.
If you prioritize enjoyment and partying, wining and dining, vis-a-vis the issues of social economic development of a country, then your prioritization is not in order.
And members of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland protest against allegations of lavish government spending. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Africans laid to rest anti-apartheid icon and Nelson Mandela's former wife, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, with full state honors at the stadium in Soweto Saturday. She was one of the most prominent figures of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement and member of parliament from 2009 until her death earlier this month. Among the nearly 40,000 mourners who attended the funeral service in her home township in Soweto, were Namibian President Hage Geingob and President Denis Sassou Nguesso of the Congo Republic. For reaction, I reached Toko Sasa, spokesperson for the South African ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC Women's League.
We were so humbled and honored as women of South Africa led by the ANC Women's League to see how Winnie Madikizela Mandela was given such a state, an official funeral by the state, which is recognition of the role she played to bring about democracy in South Africa, the role she played to fight apartheid, and as a woman who continued to be the voice and the face of the struggle throughout very difficult years when a lot of men and a lot of comrades were exiled or in jail, but she kept the fires burning throughout the time.
What do you think was Winnie Madikizela Mandela's legacy in South Africa and beyond?
So great things. It is to say, women continue to be the backbone, and therefore the recognition of her contribution is saying, even in the changes that we want to see in our society today, it is leaving behind a lesson that begins to say, women need to stand up and fight for what their rights are, for justice. They must continue to fight because the system is not yet favorable to women. But if we look into poverty, it still stares itself onto us, and it is a face of a woman, and therefore it is women who need to mobilize and come up and fight for it. They must not wait to be given. That's what she has taught us. On top of it, it has rejuvenated the society and young people to say, young people, you know, the policies that have put in place are very good and point to the direction you want to take, but it is up to you to take up the spear and make sure you stand up to it. So for us, it has just ignited a spirit that we think is going to carry South Africa forward. And South Africa can never be the same from the day Winnie Mandela passed on.
What do you say to critics who said she was controversial, she divided the nation, she even divided opinions within the ANC and the ANC's Women's League?
Unfortunately, you know, the very history that people were made to believe in was written by the very people who had a sinister agenda to make sure that what she presents is seen to be controversial, when in fact the kind of a woman of Winnie Mandela was a woman who spoke truth to power. She did not care who you are, in what position you are. If she believes this is right, she would say it. And unfortunately, by the time she lived, they could not see the visionary spirit of Winnie Mandela, because it has always been thought of visionaries are only certain leaders within the organization, never really, you know, gave that which Winnie Mandela deserved. Winnie Mandela, you know, she resembles the kind of leaders of the organization. We're not just talking about something that people could understand now, but for the future, because it was more about the future of the country, where we want to take South Africa. So nobody could understand her. So only when it gets unpacked and you can also see the conspiracies that were leveled against her in order for her not to rise as a woman, so that other women can also not support her.
So what is the ANC Women's League going to do to preserve her legacy?
First and foremost, for us as the Women's League, as part of the centenary of the women's struggle, we are saying this is the time to write her story, not just Winnie Mandela, but women's stories, women who made a contribution. Because it's high time Winnie Mandela has even opened an opportunity where now women's contributions can be placed at the fore, but it is us women and women who have been there who need to write those stories or to tell those stories. We need to rewrite our history as women.
Toko Sasa is the spokesperson for the South African ruling party, the African National Congress or ANC Women's League. She spoke with me from Soweto, South Africa. The surprise handshake between Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and main opposition leader, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, is generating mixed reaction. Analysts say the handshake might have reconfigured the East African country's politics ahead of next general election scheduled for 2022. The gesture came after dialogue between the president and the opposition leader at the State House in the capital, Nairobi. But critics in the opposition National Super Alliance, or NASA, accuse Odinga of being a sellout, weeks after refusing to recognize Uhuru Kenyatta's recent electoral victory. For reaction, I reached Dr. Mustafa Ali, a Kenyan political analyst in the capital, Nairobi.
The handshake was good. It was positive. It reduced political temperatures and the negative energies that we were seeing going around the country with political leaders abusing and accusing one another. What the handshake has done is to reduce those temperatures significantly and positively. The handshake has caused a massive fallout within the opposition in Kenya. And now we see that the core leaders within the NASA movement, in which Raila Odinga was one of the leaders, have actually abandoned Raila Odinga and have stated clearly that they are not part or party to the handshake.
Did Raila Odinga, the main opposition leader who challenged President Uhuru Kenyatta in the last presidential election, who refused to endorse him as the legitimately elected president, say the motivation behind his decision to go to the State House and negotiate, or for that matter, broker a deal with President Uhuru Kenyatta?
What happened really is that Raila Odinga is playing now 2022 politics, and the handshake itself between Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta is geared towards perhaps changing the landscape in 2022. Within the Jubilee Party, we have the Deputy President William Ruto, who has been earmarked to run on Jubilee ticket and with the support of the two majority tribes in Kenya. Now, Raila Odinga was not going to be on the ballot in 2022 based on the internal agreement that they had within the NASA camp. And so I think Raila Odinga is trying to shake that pre-election memorandum of understanding between himself, Wetangula, and Kalonzo Musyoka, and actually now put himself on the ballot in 2022 after breaking NASA.
Some people are calling him a sellout and that they supported him and he let them down. Do you think their criticisms are justified?
Well, there are those criticisms that have been leveled against the persona of Raila Odinga. And when dealing with him, they should have known that Raila is just basically playing politics. And politics in Kenya is about ethnic entrepreneurs, is about tribal entrepreneurs, is a dirty game. And so in a context where politics is based on nothing other than personalities, is not based on ideology, they should have known that this was bound to happen. And what political leaders in Kenya then should do, both in opposition and in government, is to attempt or start to engage in politics of ideology, politics that is issue-based rather than the kind of tribal politics that we are seeing carrying the day in the country today.
Dr. Lee, some Kenyans are saying the handshake is like a nail in the coffin of the opposition NASA coalition because it appears Raila Odinga is the glue that put all of them together. Him not being there, there's a possibility of disintegration of the NASA coalition, the biggest opposition party in Kenya. Do you subscribe to that assessment?
Partly. The handshake has shaken and rattled the opposition. It's very difficult to see how the other leaders within the opposition are going to marshal and garner the kind of political support that Raila normally does to actually march into state house or to win the presidency. And so Raila still commands a huge political following, and what Raila says is basically what significant numbers in opposition are going to follow. What the handshake also does is it does put into question the candidature of the current Vice President William Ruto. Is he really going to run in 2022 under Jubilee ticket and succeed?
Where does this leave the political temperature in Kenya currently?
For now, and thankfully so, the political temperatures have gone down. Now, what is happening is a lot of wheeling and dealing behind the scenes. We have leaders of a major tribe in Kenya, ethnic communities in Kenya, moving around the country, and there is a lot of realignment going on behind the scenes. And it's very difficult to see how that is going to pan out in the coming months and years. So 2022 remains an open race as far as I'm concerned.
Mustafa Ali is a Kenyan political analyst. He spoke with me from Nairobi. Over 5,000 members of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKOSWA, protested in the capital Mbabane Saturday. They were demonstrating against what they said was the extravagant government spending to celebrate the 50th birthday celebration of King Nswati III and the 50th independence anniversary of the kingdom. It came after the government issued a statement saying there will not be any salary increase for public sector workers this year. For more on their demands, I reach Induduzi Jina, Secretary General for the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKOSWA, in the capital Mbabane.
Members of the federation, but leaders of the various federations and shop stewards and activists, delivered a petition on the Friday, 13th April. One of the issues that we were raising was then the issue of extravagance. At a time when the salaries of the workers in the public sector had not been increased for the period of 2017, the government has offered a 0% increase. And again, the government has also issued a circular to the effect that all workers in the state-owned enterprises, the salaries will not be increased for the period 2018. Yet, at the same time, they are contradicting themselves with extravagant parties that are lined up in celebration for the 50-50, the 50 years of the birth of His Majesty and the 50 years of the country having attained its independence. It is our view that the issue of the celebration of a Jubilee, it can't be held by a country that is in an economic crisis, a country that is having its health sector in a crisis, its educational sector in a crisis.
Did the petition require the government to answer within a time frame? And what are your expectations?
In fact, in our petition, we have indicated that if then our issues have not been attended to, we would be coming again. And again, it is important that I correct it, that the colleagues that in the journalists, if you were to send me a WhatsApp number where I can send you pictures of this, you could see that we were not 2,000. When they came to us, whites who were there, they said we were more than 5,000. But now they have reported that we were just around 2,000. We were many in any event. So we had promised, and we are not threatening the government, that come end of May, if the issues have not been attended to, we would come double, and the end of June and the end of July. And we are planning for a national stay away from work for a period not less than 5 days at the beginning of September.
Will Tukoswa be able to sustain this, taking cognizance of the fact that sometimes the government might not react the way you want it to react?
No, we'll definitely be. I think it has taken, for us, it has taken so much time for the workers of the country being taken for a ride. And definitely we'll sustain the program that we have put forward.
But supporters of the government are saying that the fact that the government is unable financially to meet the obligations of increasing the living wages of public sector workers doesn't mean that the country's sovereignty or the country's celebration of its 50th anniversary should be relegated to the background.
No, it is not a question of relegating it to the background. It is a question of priorities. You cannot say on the one hand that you don't have money to deal with issues of importance. It is a question of priorities. If you prioritize enjoyment and partying, wining and dining, vis-a-vis the issues of social economic development of a country, then your prioritization is not in order.
The government on occasions accused some members of your group of seeking to create tension and plunge the country into chaos and into crisis, and that some of you are terrorists trying to undermine the territorial integrity of the country. Is this your plan of protest to destabilize the country's peace and stability?
It is not, and it would never be. And clearly, there are laws that are in place. And the country has put in place the Suppression of Terrorism Act. Why are they not gunning for those individuals and arresting them in terms of the Suppression of Terrorism Act? It is a trite rule that he who alleges must prove. It is clear if one is alleging any terrorist intentions or allegations or claims against us, that person is allowed to use the Suppression of Terrorism Act and go for that person.
Ndudusi Jina is the Secretary General for the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or Tukoswa. He spoke with me from Mbabane. As part of the Zimbabwean government's effort to cut spending, the Ministry of Finance this week announced cabinet decisions on dealing with money-losing state-owned businesses. Some have been earmarked for liquidation and some for privatization. For VOA, Kudzai's Vainavashi has the report from the capital, Harare.
Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa explains the cabinet's goals for the reforms of state-owned businesses.
Government has been pursuing a program of state enterprises reform designed to enhance performance, improve service delivery, and to bring more order, discipline, and rationality to the sector as a whole.
Some entities have been merged with others, and some have been incorporated into government departments. Other companies have had their mandates reviewed, others are earmarked for partial privatization, while some will be sold off entirely. Ashok Chakravarti is an economist and a consultant in the presidential office that runs the Ease of Doing Business program.
You know, one of the biggest problems in Zimbabwe is the budget deficit of the government. This process of disposing parastatals is quite an important strategy for reducing the deficit and bringing it down to manageable levels.
Chakravarti says there is an estimated $15 billion in capital in the state enterprises and says it is unfortunate that most are not contributing to the national budget. The government owns all or part of more than 90 companies, from an airline to telecommunications companies to financial institutions. Many of them have lost millions of dollars or are burdened by debts of hundreds of millions of dollars. Munyaradzi Dodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament business and other political events. He says it is a good move, but has some concerns.
You know, ZANU-PF always has brilliant ideas, they have brilliant concepts, papers, but where they fail is always the execution. The execution always comes down to nothing. So I don't dispute that Patrick Chinamas has a brilliant idea on merging these parastatals, but they cannot execute to save themselves.
Critics fear the liquidation and merging of companies will lead to job losses. Chakravarti says that some jobs may be eliminated, but over the long term, more efficient companies and a lower national debt will create more jobs. He adds that if successfully implemented, the reforms will not only attract foreign investment, but also draw domestic investment as well. The government will maintain control on key sectors such as power, roads infrastructure, and energy. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
A senior UN migration official says a main success of Friday's UN pledging conference for Democratic Republic of Congo is that it has put that country's forgotten humanitarian crisis back on the international agenda. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Donors have pledged $528 million for urgently needed humanitarian aid in DR Congo, making a significant dent in the UN's efforts to raise $1.7 billion. Jean-Philippe Chosy is the International Organization for Migration Chief of Mission in DRC. He tells VOA the conference also has succeeded in drawing international attention to the severity of the crisis in the country.
Just over the past 2 years, the number of Congolese displaced by the violence has increased by more than 200%. As we talk now, we have about 4.5 million internally displaced Congolese and more than 13 million people in need. And the crisis is also affecting provinces, and until about a year ago were relatively stable, the Kasai, for instance, or Tanganyika.
6 months ago, the United Nations declared the Kasai, Tanganyika, and South Kivu as a level 3 emergency, its highest level emergency. The DRC government, which has called this designation exaggerated and insulting, boycotted its own pledging conference. Chosy says the humanitarian crisis is spreading rapidly, and the DRC government has a responsibility to protect its people from the violence generated by armed groups and ethnic tension. During his 3 years as mission chief, Chosy says he has traveled widely throughout the DRC. He says he continues to be shocked by the desperate conditions under which the displaced are forced to live, especially those who are crammed in communal centers.
When you see Congolese families that are living literally in the two pieces of sticks and a piece of cloth or plastic, without any latrines, without any water and sanitation, without any proper food, without any health, it is profoundly shocking. And I would not hesitate to qualify some of these living conditions as inhuman.
Chosy says IOM is in the process of moving people out of these atrocious collective centers into sites that meet proper international standards. He notes this is just one of the many essential aid projects that will be made possible by generous funding from donor countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. World Cup-bound Tunisia have moved up 9 places to number 14 on April's FIFA World Rankings, their highest ever position. Their move comes on the back of 1-0 wins over Iran and Costa Rica in friendly matches in March. It's the highest position for any African nation since Ivory Coast were ranked 13th in July of 2013. Senegal, another team heading to Russia, are second on the continent and 28th globally. Africa's other three World Cup teams are closely ranked on the overall list, with Morocco at 42, Egypt 46, and Nigeria the lowest of the four at 47. Tunisia's 9th place gain was the biggest on the continent, matched only by Tanzania, who are now 37th in Africa and 137th globally. The Tanzanians' gain comes after a 4-1 loss to Algeria and a 2-0 win over the highly ranked DR Congo. The biggest losers on the continent were Liberia, who dropped 16 places to number 151 overall and 45th in Africa. Germany and Brazil remained first and second respectively on the global rankings, with Belgium gaining 2 spots to grab 3rd place. With the new rankings, Africa's top 10 are as follows in descending order. Tunisia at number 1, followed by Senegal, DR Congo, Morocco, Egypt, Nigeria, Cameroon, Ghana, Burkina Faso, and Cape Verde at number 10. At the Commonwealth Games, Uganda's Joshua Kiprui Cheptegei won the athletics men's 10,000 meters final during the 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games at the Karara Stadium on the Gold Coast on Friday. Cheptegei, who initially objected to doing the 10,000 meters, emulated Moses Indiame Kipsiro's 2010 New Delhi Commonwealth Games feat. Kipsiro was the first man in more than 70 years to win both the 5,000 meters and the 10,000 meter races at the Commonwealth Games. Meanwhile, world champion Helen Obiri led compatriot Margaret Kemboi to a 1-2 finish in the women's 5,000 meters on Saturday. Obiri, who is also the Olympic silver medalist over the distance, clocked 15:13.11, with Kip Kemboi second in 15:15.28. England's 1500 meters specialist Laura Whitman timed 15:25.84 for bronze, as Uganda's Juliet Chepkwel coming fourth in a season best of 15:30.17. In another development, up to 5 more African athletes at the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games are also believed to be on the run, joining 8 missing members from Team Cameroon. Sierra Leone's men's double squash players Ernest Yombla and Yusuf Masarai failed short for matches, including one on Friday against India. Petit David Likwamba of Cameroon is among athletes who went missing from the game's village. 2 athletes from Uganda and 1 from Rwanda also believed to be unaccounted for. They join 8 Cameroonians, 5 boxers and 3 weightlifters who disappeared from the athletes' village in recent days. Games officials say the athletes have now officially breached their visas, which expired today, Sunday, May 15th. The rest of the Cameroonian team and its officials flew home after the mass desertion, which amounts to 1/3 of their team. Rwanda has confirmed its weightlifting coach, Jean-Paul Nsengiyumva, went missing from the Commonwealth Games in Australia on Tuesday. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Shakira and Beyonce from Miami. Yeah. is all in my head, oh girl. Why you come to do me this, oh girl? I close my eyes and you all I see, oh girl. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, you must be one of a kind. That's you.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The international community is going through a perilous period. Despite the dark clouds gathering, the Security Council has been unable to fulfill its grave responsibility under the Charter. Since the time when the late Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali was denied a second term because of the use of a veto, Secretaries General following have been rather cautious in using their full powers under the Charter. But last week, the current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, spoke bravely before the Security Council, relying on his authority under Article 99 of the Charter. He asserted correctly that the Cold War had returned with a vengeance, and he mentioned some of the critical crises in the Middle East, such as in Yemen, the Gaza Strip, and that in Syria, as the terrible points facing the international community. But despite his speech, the Security Council has not been able to act. The issue of the use of chemical weapons has no consensus in the Security Council. While the Western powers assert that the government of Syria has used chemical weapons in Burma, allies of the president of Syria deny this, saying that the nuclear weapons have not been used. And in fact, the Russian foreign minister asserted that whether or not chemical weapons was used was staged by the NGO White Helmets. The way now forward has become dangerous. And last Friday, about 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, President Trump announced that the United States and its NATO allies, Great Britain and France, have launched a targeted limited strike on so-called chemical facilities in Syria. After the strike, which lasted for 50 minutes, professionals at the Pentagon carefully outlined the three targets and also made clear that the operation did not involve either Russian or Iranian targets, and they called it a one-off operation. The Syrian government confirmed the strikes and asserted that they had shot down 14 of the missiles. The repercussions have not been too clear. But what one could say, particularly this commentator among his other duties in the United Nations, for 20 years was responsible for the Middle East. He knows the terrain very well and knows the cross currents very well in the area. and it could be affirmed that despite this limited strike, nothing much has changed. The possibility of escalation is very great, and this will affect the global community. What needs to be done now is for the non-permanent members of the Security Council, the 10 non-permanent members, to assume responsibility as was done in 1973 following the Yom Kippur or October War, when at that time the Israeli army crossed the Suez Canal and partially surrounded the Third Egyptian Army. The then Soviet Union made clear it could not allow any destruction of the Third Army, and we were in a very difficult situation. Then President Nixon had issued some nuclear alerts, and in that means the 10 non-permanent members said they could not sit idly by. And having consulted with the Secretary General and the senior staff, they went ahead and asked for the reintroduction of peacekeeping force in the Middle East, something which was thought impossible since peacekeeping came to an end in 1964 after the Congo operation. What is now required is for the 10 non-permanent members to assume responsibility and try in their own way to save succeeding generation from the possibility of war. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if a monkey is amongst dogs, why won't it start barking? I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In November 1993, David Ngele became the first Botswana to openly disclose he was living with HIV. Over the past 25 years, more courageous individuals have followed him in making public disclosures, though they represent a small percentage of the estimated 360,000 Botswana who are living with HIV. Many of those who have publicly disclosed their HIV status in Botswana have stated that the virus has been less oppressive than the stigma attached to it. While public displays of stigma and discrimination are not as frequent and visible as in years past, many people have endured the incredibly painful experience of being stigmatized because of their HIV status, often by the same family and friends whom they look to for love and acceptance. In order to support these brave men and women, PEPFAR, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, has funded BONEPWA Plus to implement the Treat All Champions campaign. The campaign has enlisted 30 people living openly with HIV to mobilize their communities to address stigma and other barriers that prevent Botswana from knowing their status or enrolling on life-saving antiretroviral treatment if they are diagnosed with HIV. Through the Treat All strategy, launched by President Khama in 2016, all Botswana living with HIV now have the opportunity to enroll in antiretroviral treatment immediately upon their diagnosis. Over the past 15 years, the U.S. government, through PEPFAR, has not only saved and improved millions of lives, but has also transformed the global HIV-AIDS response. through PEPFAR's strategy for accelerating HIV/AIDS epidemic control, as many as 13 countries, including Botswana, could achieve epidemic control by 2020. Since 2004, PEPFAR has supported the government of Botswana with $950 million for HIV prevention, treatment, and care. PEPFAR is also implementing specific strategies to address the largest gaps in the HIV response, primarily in reaching youth aged 15 to 24 and men aged over 30. The United States is proud to partner with Botswana and more than 50 other countries toward controlling and ultimately ending their HIV/AIDS epidemics.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.